No taxation without representation. 200 years of exploitation in the capital of this nation. No representation in the capital of this nation. 200 years of exploitation. Give the people their right to vote. Someone asked me, was it true? The voting rights of the district were long overdue.
That was Sweet Honey in the Rock with Give the People Their Right to Vote. Hello and welcome to Shadow Politics, an hour-long grassroots talk show which will attempt to shine a light on the issues that you care about. I'm your host, United States Senator Michael D. Brown, coming to you live from the District of Columbia, America's last colony. I hope my show will start a dialogue with America about the issues that are important in the lives of all of us. And tonight, we have a very special guest. We have Professor Eduardo Ferrer, and he's nice enough to be with us, and he is the director of the Georgetown Juvenile Justice Initiative, advocating to improve the D.C. juvenile justice system. Lord, don't we need that? And as a visiting professor at Georgetown University Law Center, supervising students in the Juvenile Justice Clinic. Professor Ferrer is also a certified trainer in the Galt Center's Youth Defense Advocacy Program and conducts training for juvenile defense attorneys across the country. Professor Ferrer, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you so much for having me, Senator.
We have such a big, big problem here in the District of Columbia, and it seems that we're just starting to get, trying to make a difference legislatively about it. So let me start by asking you, what do you think about the most recent efforts to try to get a handle on things? And specifically, I mean the federal government multi-agency commitment to intervening in the juvenile justice process, and also the Secure DC bill. Do you know about either one of these, and what do you think? You think they'll have an impact?
I do, and I unfortunately am not optimistic that they'll have the impact that we want to see, either in the short term or the long term. I think the reality of it is what we really all want is for harm not to happen in the first place.
Yeah.
And both of these efforts really represent changing or modifying the way that we react once harm happens, rather than really leaning into building the type of prevention, intervention, and public health approach that we would need and want in order to make sure that we're both flattening the curve of the trends that we're seeing now and continuing to drive those trends down over the long run.
Well, aren't we in triage right now? I mean, isn't the problem big enough? I mean, we've got a 14-year-old shooting the star running back of the Commanders. We've got congressman being carjacked. We've got another one being assaulted in her apartment building. 2 days ago, we had a carjacking that resulted in two deaths, I know a third person was shot. I don't know if they've survived or not. But don't we need to do something immediately to stop the violence before we can move on to what the cause, addressing the causes in the first place?
I don't think it's mutually exclusive. I actually think doing something urgent and immediate is very much in line with prevention and intervention. It's an interesting time in the city in terms of crime. I've been here for 25 years, and I am with everyone where it feels very different right now than it has in a long time in the city. At the same time, in 2022, DC hit multi-generational lows for the number of violent crimes in the city and the amount of overall crime in the city. We saw a significant uptick in 23, but it was from what was generational lows. I mean, even with the significant uptick in 23, we still have far fewer violent crimes. We had about 5,300 violent crimes last year in D.C. When Mayor Williams left office, we had almost 8,000, right? So we're still significantly lower than we've been in the past, but we've seen some really scary trends over the last few years. We've seen an increase in homicide. We've seen an increase in carjackings. And overall, we've seen an increase in the number of violent crimes that are taking place with a gun, right? So while violent crimes have dropped significantly overall, the types of violent crimes that are taking place are scary. And by the way, this is applicable to both kids and adults, right? This isn't just kids driving this. In fact, when you look at the trends with young people, it gets more nuanced and even more complicated. More kids are arrested for carjackings, yes, but we have a really low closure rate. So we don't necessarily know just how much of a problem that is or to what degree that problem is. When you look at homicides and gun violence that results in injuries, the number of kids involved has gone up, but overall, kids still make up a really small portion of that overall number. And so part of what I think it's important that we really do is not be reactive, right? That's not to say not take this seriously, not act with urgency, but it's to really look at the nuance and the detail to figure out what's driving this and then respond in a way that gets ahead of it, right, rather than just reacts to it.
Well, that sounds like a great idea. But I think, you know, in politics, we have this saying, Professor, that if you're unemployed, unemployment is 100%. The optics of this are very bad, right? We have it all over the city now. We have people being shot. I live in one of the most bucolic neighborhoods in the city, and we just had a murder three blocks from here of a teenage girl in a hotel room. You know, we're seeing... And the carjacking with the carjackings with the kids and the kids shooting each other, this is just really bad optics. And politically, we don't get into the weeds, right? We don't understand that violent crime is actually going down because it looks like it's going up to us. So how much have you been able to look at the Secure DC bill, for example, and see if the tweaks that they are making, are they reactionary? Are they, you know, because the public is all upset about this, regardless of what the situation is? Or do you think they're really concrete to, it really makes sense to expand police powers and pretrial detention and, you know, change the definition of carjacking? Are these things that will help, or is this just window dressing?
It's, from my perspective, it's primarily window dressing. Hmm. The reality of it is a lot of these things we've tried in the past, right?
Yep.
Some of these policies are similar to policies that were pursued in the 90s, in the 80s and the 70s. They didn't make us less safe. And honestly, we've learned a ton since that time period as well. These policies have been evaluated. Pretrial detention doesn't make us more safe over the long term. Increased penalties don't deter crime. Changing the definition of carjacking is not going to be something that deters carjacking. On the flip side, we also know what has been working here in D.C., and that's the frustrating part for me. So CJCC just released their violent crime trends analysis, looking at violent crime from 2008 to 2023. And what they found was if you look at the cure violence site, so this is what I'm talking about, intervention rather than the reaction, right? We've got our violence interrupters. If you look at the cure violence sites last year, D.C. year over year had a 10% increase in assault with a deadly weapons with a gun and homicide gun incidents. In the cure violence sites, there was a 10% decrease, right? So a huge swing, even in the ONES offices, so the Office of Neighborhood Safety and Great Engagement, which runs its own violence interruption sites, where the city increased 10%, violence in those sites only increased 1%, right? So we know what is working, and we know ways to get ahead of the violence, right, to prevent it from happening in the first place. Why are we not scaling those sites up? Why aren't we leaning more into these programs that are working to get ahead of the violence rather than leaning into, honestly, borrowing from policies that have been tried and failed in the past rather than what is working?
Well, excuse my ignorance, but tell me exactly what are these sites that you're talking about?
Yeah, absolutely. So the Office of Neighborhood Safety and Engagement was an office that was created out of the NEAR Act. And the goal was to try and build out a public health approach to violence in the district. So we're not just going to react to it. We're going to build out our ability to prevent it and to intervene before it happens. So prevent the root causes, address the root causes, and then intervene when it happens. And the ONES office, or the Office of Neighborhood Safety and Engagement, runs a number of violence interruption programs. So they identify places in the city that are hotspots for violence. They put resources into those hotspots, including identifying the folks who are going to be most at risk of violence or most at risk of perpetrating violence. And they try and address the root causes individually with those folks, or they try and quell some of the disputes that lead to violence between neighborhoods, between individuals. The Office of the Attorney General runs a similar program called Cure Violence, which is based on a evidence-based program that started in Chicago, has fantastic results, not just around the country, but around the world. And we're seeing great results here in D.C., a 10% decrease in ADW gun and homicide incidents year over year in the sites that they run. And it's a very similar model of violence interruption. Engage in the folks who are most at risk of either being on the receiving end or the shooting end of a gun. Try and address the risk factors that they have and support them so that they do not become either a perpetrator of violence or a victim of violence. And that's really a win-win for everyone, right? It's preventing the harm from happening in the first place.
Well, I agree with that. And, you know, we just recently had a woman on the show, Tia Bell. Are you familiar with her? Yeah. And, you know, a similar approach, right? She's trying to figure out why kids want guns and how to keep them from wanting guns, which is obviously the ultimate approach. But from the article I read in the Hill Rag, where I learned about you, I also read that the system seems to be failing at every level. Like the welfare system is failing these kids, DYRS is failing these kids, the D.C. Attorney General's office are failing these kids. Is that the truth? Are we failing? They had a flow chart of a kid going through the system, and it was just a ridiculously complicated thing from my perspective. And in the end, the kid gets out. So is the system really working? Don't we have What are the fixes that we need in the system?
Yeah, it's a fantastic question and very multifaceted, right? And there are a number of agencies that are failing. I don't happen to believe that the Office of the Attorney General is one of them, but CFSA, the Child and Family Services Agency, Department of Behavioral Health, DYRS, our housing agencies, these are all agencies that could be doing so much better. Let me give you a couple more data points that puts this into context, right? So CJCC, the Criminal Justice Coordinating Council, did another fantastic report on the factors that drive young people into the juvenile legal system, right? And what they found that before a young person gets system involved, the kind of typical youth with juvenile legal system involvement, 12% of them have been homeless. 50% of them have substantiated cases of neglect in the home. 45% of them have been suspended from their schools. 44% have diagnosed behavioral health difficulties. 45% of them are eligible for special education services through schools, right? There are all these tremendous intervention points that we're missing before a young person gets involved in the delinquency system because those agencies aren't working as well as they should be. And then, lo and behold, a young person gets involved in the delinquency system. And that only adds another layer. The systems that are still, by and large, responsible for providing a lot of the rehabilitative services are the Department of Behavioral Health, are the schools. And so unless we address the systemic failures at those other agencies, the delinquency system isn't ever going to be what we want it to be. But also, if we do address those systemic failures at those other agencies, we're going to have far fewer young people falling into the system, which means a lot less harm for all of us as a community.
In this article I read, I heard you refer to the bureaucracy that engulfs these kids as an ecosystem. Do we have too much bureaucracy? Is that part of the problem? That there should the process be simplified somehow? Would that help?
Yes. And part of that, to be completely honest, is it's a lack of planning and a lack of coordination across agencies. So the District of Columbia is very siloed, right? Everyone kind of sees their, you know, this is my lane, I'm going to stay in it. Or this is my lane and I'm going to stay in it. Lanes don't matter to kids, right? When a kid needs therapy, we need to be able to find a way to cut through all of that and provide that person with someone who's going to show up and support that kid in that time of need. That's what we need as a city to be safe. That's what that young person needs in order to thrive and accomplish the goals that we want all of our kids in the city to accomplish. But, you know, we'll try. I'll give you an example. We'll try to get a young person connected to behavioral health services, let's say individual therapy. And the process is you call the Access Helpline through the Department of Behavioral Services, and they're supposed to set up an intake with what's called a core services agency, this community-based provider that's going to connect that young person to services. Young person, you know, that intake may take 2-3 weeks to set up. Young person attends the intake. Someone says, we'll reach out to you. Weeks go by. No one's reached out. We're following it up constantly, right? As their attorneys, we're really trying to push through and help. You know, this is how crazy it is, right? A 14-year-old needs an attorney who's in their third year of law school or beyond to help them navigate a bureaucracy to get the services that we want young people to have. And it's hard. It's hard for us as trained professionals to try and accomplish this, let alone we hear from parents all the time how desperately they tried to navigate this bureaucracy on their own before young people got into trouble and how frustrating and unsuccessful it was.
Well, and, you know, I'm going to give you a testimony here. My son, who is I know that you, in this article, talk about individualized learning plans. To which many of these people are eligible. My son, who was dyslexic, we had an individualized learning plan done for him at GW. It was so nice. The professors at GW put this plan together for him, and then the school never once implemented it. My son, because they were too busy to do it, my son barely got out of high school, got into college, finished in 4 years at the top of his class because he went to a college that knew how to deal with people that were dyslexic. So, you know, putting young people in touch with the right people that can help them is so important. It's so important. I don't know why we ignore it so much. And to me, it seems more cost-effective. Is it not? Is it not more cost-effective to keep kids out of crime than it is to arrest them, prosecute them, incarcerate them? And, you know, economically, it doesn't even make sense for us to intervene early?
1,000%, right? The return on investment on early intervention programs, on evidence-based programs that don't require kids to get in trouble first is so much higher than reacting through the delinquency system. I mean, you know, Frederick Douglass had it right when he said that it's easier to build strong children than to repair broken men.
Yeah. Well, let me ask you, what's the difference with children today, do you think, that's adding to this problem? For example, I was flabbergasted when this 14-year-old shot Commander's running back in a carjacking episode. he's 14 years old. This running back, Robinson, who may be the best player on the team, is also 6'2" and 240 pounds. I would have been intimidated by that when I was 14 years old, even if I had a gun in my hand. Why aren't these kids intimidated? Why aren't they scared by the system? Is there something different about them, different about the environment that they live in? Something's changed?
So, yeah, let me say yes and no. I don't think kids are different. I don't think they're somehow more evil or less scared. I do think the context, I think young people right now, particularly teenagers right now, have a very different context that they're growing up in than, for instance, you or I did. But let me break it down a little bit. Number one is, I'm not so sure that kid wasn't scared, right? He may have behaved as if he wasn't scared, but he's still a kid after all, right? But right. We have to also remember the 14-year-olds and the 15-year-olds that we are encountering now were 12 years old, 13 years old during the pandemic, right? During an incredible period of social isolation where many were disconnected from positive supports, positive adults that they had going on in their lives, and that we haven't done a good job of figuring out how to really repair those connections since the pandemic has, you know, kind of ceased or slowed down, or since we've returned to a more normalized routine and approach. And so very different context for our young people, for our teenagers today in terms of their childhood. I'll say the other big difference that they've experienced in terms of context is the incredible proliferation of guns in this country over the last 10 years and how that's found its way into the District of Columbia. There seem to be more guns on the street now than at any point that I've been in this city. And young people are growing up in that context, and to be quite frank, among that fear that they may be the person who doesn't have a gun. And so we're seeing that shape and change behavior in a way that, you know, as children, we really didn't have to confront.
Well, we see that. I mean, I think that young people make the big mistake that having a gun empowers them when it does exactly the opposite. You know, if you shoot somebody, if you kill somebody, you not only kill them, you've ruined your life at 14 years old, right? You're in the system and probably in the system for life. You know, one thing that I find perplexing about that is I always had access to guns. All my friends all had access to guns. We were brought up as the children of World War II veterans, and there were guns in most of the homes, but we didn't go out and rob, and we didn't carjack, and we didn't, you know, it seems to me, are these kids subjected to more pressures due to things like social media, do you think? We didn't have that.
So I definitely think that's part of it. Let me go back to your other point real quick about kind of the motive for why kids have guns. It doesn't seem so much as empowerment. In a way, it can be seen as that way. In a way, to be completely honest, it is a felt need for self-defense. There was a great study that was done in New York that interviewed young people as to why they were carrying guns. And it was very rational. They knew that the use of a gun could really jeopardize their future. But that was outweighed by the fear they had that they were going to have no future, that they would be the victim if they were caught unprepared. And this isn't to excuse it, right? This isn't to say this is the life we want for young people or that this is pro-social behavior. But when you're weighing the risk of death versus the risk of potential incarceration, it is rational to weigh that risk of death much higher. And so a lot of young people cite the need for safety, for self-defense, as the reason that they're carrying guns. To your second point about, though, there's a difference between carrying a gun for self-defense, right, and using a gun in the commission of a robbery or a carjacking, right? And that is a big difference. And I do think this is where adolescence and trauma really play a large role in decision-making of teenagers, right? They're young, they're risk-taking, they're impulsive, they tend to value rewards greater than they're valuing the risks of a situation. And none of this is to excuse the decisions, right? But to contextualize how these decisions are being made. And then you layer peer pressure on top of that. Plus what we are seeing, which it does seem to be that carjacking has become, crime tends to be faddish, it seems like, to begin with. And this seems like one of the new fads. We've had the kind of Kia Boy challenge with the car theft, and right, carjacking as well seems to be another fad as well. And so it's this overall, to your point, right, that's another element of a different context in which young kids are growing up. So they had to deal with the pandemic, unaddressed trauma from the pandemic. They're dealing in a world where there's increased access to guns and where there's this pressure to engage in this type of behavior. And we're seeing all that come together with other factors as well into some of the trends that we're seeing now.
Well, I've been in politics in D.C. for 18 years, and guns have been a constant struggle for us during that time period, and even before, I'm sure, because of the we have pretty tough gun laws in the District of Columbia, but it really doesn't matter much because they have pretty loose gun laws in Virginia. So exactly, we get a lot of them in over the border, and you know, it's crazy to me that almost every kid in the district seems to have access to a gun if they want it, an illegal gun. I mean, all the guns we had were our parents' guns, or we hunted with them or whatever. But now they seem to be all over the street, and I don't know what we can do about that. Is there anything we can do about that in your mind? I mean, we've passed pretty tough laws, but...
I'll say that's one of the most frustrating things for me, right, is because I feel like D.C. is trying to do its part to reduce gun violence. We've seen this horrible proliferation of just the manufacturing of guns. And to be completely frank and transparent, I'm actually a big proponent of the Second Amendment, but just not kind of on demand and whatever type of gun you want, right? And we've seen this just tremendous manufacturing of guns in the United States. And I'm looking at the ATF data right now. You look at 2021, ATF recovered 619 guns from Virginia in the District of Columbia. The next highest was 164 from Maryland, right? And so what's happening practically is this kind of our national approach to guns is impacting the District of Columbia. But we're in many ways restricted in how we can respond to that, other than what ends up happening is people calling to lock up our own, right? And so it's really frustrating that this problem that starts outside of our borders is doubly harming, both creating victims of our own residents, really seriously either harming or killing our own residents, and then taking away the lives of others because they're now being put in jail for having perpetrated that violence, right? And that just can't be what we're okay with. We have to push our partners in Virginia, Maryland, and elsewhere. We have to push our partners at the federal level to do more to prevent guns from coming into the District of Columbia in the first place. If we're content with, as D.C., to just sit and wait on our hands and try and bail water out of the boat once guns are here, we're just never going to get ahead of the issue.
Yeah, it just seems that it's getting worse and worse every year, no matter what we try to do. And, you know, and from what I do, there was legislation actually 15 years ago to give the District of Columbia a vote, and it was killed by the fact that these guys put a gun rider on the bill. Senator from Nevada named Ensign put a gun rider on the bill that would have allowed you to carry an automatic weapon in Lafayette Park across the street from the White House. It's just absolutely crazy. Well, we've talked a little bit about what not working in legislation. Do you have some good legislation that you'd like to see happen?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's some really creative and important stuff that's pending at the council, right? So we talk about the importance of providing prevention and intervention services. Councilmember White's bill to create a training pipeline for social workers, I thought was critical. You think about the importance of really supporting parents in terms of prevention and in terms of reducing childhood stress and childhood trauma. And we've got a bill that I think will be voted on soon. I think it made it out of committee that would make home visiting programs, which have great return on investments, right? You were talking about earlier, great return on investments for home visiting programs, would make that eligible for Medicaid repayment. Child tax, and I think that was Councilmembers Henderson and Addo. Councilmember Parker and his child tax credit legislation. Councilmember Lewis George and her SNAP legislation, right? Things that we can do to really strengthen our safety net, to provide resources to the families that need it most in order to reduce their stress, in order to prevent childhood trauma. There was a great article in the Post yesterday about the direct cash assistance program pilot that was run through Miriam's Kitchen, I believe it was. And it was just direct cash assistance, $10,000 to new mothers in order to help their kids have a stronger first year of their life. And it was life-changing for these women and for these families. Those and I believe in total about 1,300 people applied for a program where there were about 132 spots. If we were to fully fund that, 1,300 slots a year for the program, that's $17 million. That's a drop in the bucket in our overall budget. That's about half of what we spend just on juvenile incarceration and detention a year. Imagine if we were to spend that money just investing directly in young people and their families from the get-go. We would see a lot better outcomes. The reality of it is, at the end of the day, healthy communities, thriving communities, that's what makes a safe community. And when we talk about public safety narrowly, we're missing the boat. Public safety is a byproduct of health and of success. And that's really what we should be shifting our focus to. It's also more equitable.
Well, it's so, you know, it's so ironic for me to hear you talk about this, because when I'm 70 years old, and when I was in graduate school, I worked on a thing called the Family Assistance Plan that was put forth by a senator named Daniel Moynihan and supported by Richard Nixon. And it's exactly what you're talking about. It was about giving negative tax payments, like dismantling the welfare system and giving tax. It was called a negative income tax. And it's funny that, God, I want to say 20 years later, but it's more like 40 or 50 years later that we're still talking about this and can't seem to make it happen. Yeah, it's certainly, you know, the most dangerous person is a person that has nothing to lose. You know, absolutely. We have to figure out a way to vest these kids in the system, do we not? We don't have jobs for them. We don't have, you know, we have to work harder to find ways to vest them in the system, don't we?
Absolutely. I mean, the reality of it is the best thing that we could do is prevent a young person from touching the juvenile legal system in the first place. But once a young person does get into the system, we could be doing so much better by them. We're really not providing them with the supports and the services that they need. And let me also say, even when we do, it's not enough, because we're not addressing the context around them. What we really need are multi-generational strategies and interventions for working with the young person, their families, and their communities, in order to make sure that young person, who's often experienced a lot of trauma themselves, is able to heal and recover for that trauma, yeah, right? Is able to repair the harm that they have caused. So I'm a big fan of restorative practices and restorative justice, right? Because we need to teach young people also that they need to repair harm as well. But then we also need to address the broader context that the young person is living in. Because if we do that with a young person and we put them back into a situation, either in their home or in their community, where that's the cause of the stress, those are where the triggers are happening, then you're not actually going to see the outcomes that you want over the long term. And so we need to do better to support not just young people, but their families as well.
Well, when you bring up a multi-generational approach, what is the responsibility of parents? You know, we see a woman, this is a national headline news these days, right, that this mother is being tried for negligence in the death of four high school students that were killed by her son. What do you think? Should parents be held responsible, or do we just need to go in and help them find their way?
Yeah, I think this notion of parental responsibility really is born or is rooted in this idea of deterrence, that if we hold parents responsible, somehow we're going to get ahead of the problem. And I just don't think that is going to work for a host of reasons. But I do think we should be more focused on parents overall. But from a support standpoint, I think we as a society overestimate the utility of threat and underestimate the utility of solidarity. And I think that if we were to provide parents with more supports, with more services, that's really our front line of defense, right? If we equip parents to be the protective factors from delinquency, from risk-taking activities that are non-pro-social, right? That's the ideal. And so what we need to be doing is investing, again, more earlier and better. Home visiting programs, direct cash assistance program, parenting support programs when they are struggling, right? I think a lot of times what we see with kids in the system is not only have they experienced a lot of trauma, but their parents have experienced a lot of trauma. Their grandparents have experienced a lot of trauma, right? And parenting through trauma is really difficult. And I think we underestimate how much support we really should be providing to parents in order to get healthy outcomes, not just for them, but for their children.
Well, I remember when a DC council member, truancy is a big problem. Obviously, it's been, you know, this has been studied, and chronic truants are more likely to be involved in crime. I was orphaned at the age of 15, and I became a chronic truant. So I went to testify before the council one time because they were going to pass it. They were trying to pass a bill that if you were caught being truant so many days, they could take welfare benefits, SNAP benefits, away from your parents, away from your mother. And I went and I testified before the council. I said, I have a 17-year-old son, and you can have him for a week, and you can see if you can make him go to school. Because if you drop him off at the front door and he doesn't want to go, he'll walk out the back door. And that's the problem with holding parents responsible, right? Is in some ways they can't be responsible when a child reaches adolescence.
I think it goes beyond that in the case of your son, right? Your son wasn't not going to school because he didn't want to. He was not going to school because it wasn't accessible to him. And that's so much of what we see, right? So, you know, DC was talking about holding the parents accountable. Well, who's holding the school accountable for implementing that IEP and making sure that someone like your son can show up in a school building where they're actually getting what they need? You know, we talk about a truancy or an absentee problem in the District of Columbia, but when I look at the data, what I see is an engagement problem. Because when you look at the data where truancy is worse or where chronic absenteeism is worse, is at the high school level. Students are effectively dropping out because schools either become inaccessible to them, or they've been told in middle school, we're going to keep suspending you, we don't want you here, or they don't see the value in the education that's being provided to them. And that's an education issue. That's as much an adult issue as it is a young person issue. And so I just, you know, that's the problem with allocating blame, right? When you point the finger at someone else, you got, what, four pointing back at you? And that's what I think we're often missing as a city, that we're not looking at what our own actions are that are contributing to the negative outcomes that we're trying to get ahead of.
First of all, I have to clear up a misunderstanding. I have to make this clear, or my son Nick's mother will just slap me when she comes home. Nick was never a chronic truant. That was just theoretical. But I was, and I dropped out of high school, and you know, and it took a lot of effort for people that loved me to get me back into school, and you know, I ended up with a master's degree after finally continuing my education. But all those things you just said were said to me. I went to a school in a suburban Montgomery County, but still the school didn't have time to deal with my acting out. So they said all those things to me. And, you know, and I was very bitter about it, actually, for a while, until I grew up and said, yeah, I did a lot. They spent a lot of time dealing with me, and they just didn't have the time to do that. But yeah, all those things were said to me. And I think that, no kid drops out of school because they can't do the work. I mean, that's not my experience I work with some high school dropouts. They drop out because of the conditions in their life or the things that are surrounding them. And I'm sure that's the same thing with them getting into crime. You know, I never robbed anybody because I had people that cared about me and invested in me and and expected things of me. What about that? What about expectations? Have we lowered expectations for our young people so acting out becomes more acceptable?
It's interesting. I don't know that we've lowered expectations. I've seen changes in expectations that young people have for themselves over the course of my time in DC. When I first started representing young people, very few of them could see past 18 or 21. They just weren't sure there was anything there for them after that. Over time, that got a lot better. I have to say there was a lot more hope and optimism amongst our young people leading into the pandemic even. Post-pandemic, I've seen a shift in the expectations young people have for themselves back closer to when I started my career, that young people just they can't see a future for themselves. And so it is a different approach to life, right? When you don't have a path to adulthood, to successful adulthood, to thriving adulthood, it does impact the decisions that you make during adolescence.
Yeah, especially because it's so hard at that age to see past the end of your nose anyway. That's what I say about 14-year-olds, having guns. I had a 14-year-old son, and he was rational, nice guy. Everybody loved him, and I wouldn't want to see him with a gun,
Right.
One time I saw him and his friend. I was on a phone with his friend's mother, and I was looking out the back window, and him and his friends were putting a garbage can on top of another garbage can, and they were going to run and jump on a platform and then hit the second grass and slam dunk the basketball. And I was thinking to myself, this looks like a Roadrunner cartoon. There are 1,000 ways this could go wrong. And why can't they see that, And of course, I stopped it before it happened. But sure as they would have executed it, somebody would have ended up in the emergency room. That's just a typical thing of being a teenager, too. And it's funny because I talked about the kid earlier that was scared. Why wasn't he scared? But I heard him interviewed in the Washington Post, saw him interviewed in the Washington Post. And he said at the moment that he pulled the trigger on the gun, the only thing he was thinking about was getting the car. He wasn't thinking about himself. He wasn't thinking about the person he shot. All he was thinking about was getting the car. And, that's just such a teenage thing. Before we go on, we just have a few more minutes, but first of all, I want to thank you for the work you do, because God bless you for helping kids that need help. You know, like I said, I grew up in a bad neighborhood, and I saw a lot of good kids get into trouble. So anything you can do to keep some of them out of the system and out of trouble, you deserve a lot of credit for that, and I thank you. Thank you. Let me ask you, since we're starting to run out of time here, what do you want to say? What haven't I asked you that you think is important to say?
You know, I want to build on those two stories that you just told, because it's so beautiful, right? Adolescence is about risk-taking, and it's going to happen regardless, right? And risk-taking we often think of as negative, but risk-taking is also trying out for the school play, right. Trying out for that sports team, right? Taking right. a class that you think is going to challenge you. And that's right. part of what we really need to focus on as adults, is recognizing kids are going to take risks. We as adults, our job is to provide them with the menu of options that encourage them to take pro-social or productive risks, right? Things that are going to build resilience or get them closer to their goals, while trying to protect them from taking risks that could really jeopardize their life or harm others. And I really think that's one of the things that we're really not doing well as a city, is recognizing that we, the adults, are responsible for that menu of options. And when we don't provide good menus for kids, they're either going to create their own menus or they're going to choose from the bad menu of options in front of them. And so if what we really want is to reduce harm in the city, to prevent crime from happening, we need a much better menu of options that's actually meaningful, that kids can actually take advantage of, that are well-resourced and that are accessible and enticing to young people.
Well, again, thank you for that, because I think it's people like you that are doing the research and investigating our youth investigations to present these options, to develop these options. And I agree with you. I remember reading an article by a famous child psychologist who said, you know, one of the things that stuck with me is he said that we try to get children to comply. For example, you know, if we have a child that tends to be argumentative and you know, and is not necessarily compliant, we try to get them to comply. And he said, that's really not the right thing to do. We should channel their energy, because the same kid that will argue with you about this or that is probably also the kid that will argue with the guy that's trying to get them to try drugs, or trying to get them to do, you know, that it's really not their personality that needs to be changed. It's just the circumstance and the ways they use that, whatever that is in them that makes them, you know, resistant. So I agree with you 100%. I think that, you know, adolescence is a tough enough time anyway. You know, my wife, I told you she was a teacher. She taught at middle school and in high school. And, man, these kids go through a lot. And at my age, I forget what it was like. I know it was a hard time, but I forget some of the specifics. But certainly these kids are going through a lot. And in D.C., we really need to find a way out of this problem. You know, I know politically it's easy for us to say lock them up, but we need a much more thorough approach and much more holistic approach to the problem, I think. And I so much appreciate the fact that you work on it. So thank you so much for being here. We'll have you again when the crime statistics start going down, which I hope will be soon.
And, that'd be good. Well, good news on that front. We are actually, if you look year over year, and it's, you know, obviously a short period of time, but homicides are down 50% compared to the same period last year. Assaults with a deadly weapon are down 30%. Violent crime is down 7%. So hopefully, knock on wood, these trends continue.
Well, and that's the best way to end the show, right, on a positive note. And thank you for the work you're doing to make that happen. And everybody else, let me ask you one last question. Do we need more cops? We're low. D.C. Police Department is woefully shorthanded right now. Do we need more cops?
So the way I think about this is it's the wrong question to ask. I think the question we need to ask ourselves as a city is what do we need to do to make sure that the number of cops that we have in D.C. today is too many?
Well, that's a great way to answer that question, and I appreciate it. And we'll see you next week, folks. Thanks again so much for Professor Eduardo Ferrer for coming on our show. Professor, I hope that we get a chance to meet in the future, and I hope you'll come back again sometime. You know, we always close our show out with a song that we dedicate to the subject matter and the people that we've had on the show, and here's one that goes out from the Beatles. Thanks again, Professor.
Thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
Asked a girl what she wanted to be. She said, baby, can't you see? I want to be famous, a star on the screen. But you can do something in between. Maybe you can drive my car. Yes, I'm gonna be a star. Maybe you can drive my car. And maybe I love you. Representation in the capital of this nation. 100 years of exploitation. Give the people their right to vote. Give the people their right to vote. Give the people their right to vote. Give the people their right to vote.